Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
Starship in Florida, lightning on Mars. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. SpaceX's mega rocket Starship launches exclusively from Boca Chica, Texas, for now. The Air Force has given the commercial company the go-ahead to continue plans to build a launch pad at Cape Canaveral Space Force Station in Florida. We'll speak with main engine cutoff host Anthony Colangelo about SpaceX's need for more launch pads and the future of Starship. Then NASA's Perseverance rover picked up an interesting sound on Mars, lightning. A microphone on the rover picked up electric sounds that scientists confirmed as mini lightning strikes. We'll speak with University of Florida's Amy Williams about the findings and what's ahead for NASA's Martian robots this holiday season. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Florida will now see even more launches after the Air Force approved a new plan for the development of a launch facility supporting SpaceX's giant Starship rocket. SpaceX currently uses a launch facility at Boca Chica, Texas. The expansion to Florida signals a greater need for launch pads and paints a clearer picture of the future of the Starship program. Here to talk more about the development in Florida and the future of the Starship program and supporting human missions to the moon and beyond is Anthony Colangelo. He's the host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff and co-host of the podcast Off Nominal. Anthony, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Always good to be here.
Hey, so the Air Force paved the way for SpaceX to launch a Starship from Florida. Why is Florida such an important launch location for SpaceX?
Well, the history goes back to... No, I'm kidding. It could be a very long story. It was a really good and empty place to launch rockets from, which is still true today. Historically, Cape Canaveral has always been an awesome spot because it's very remote and secluded from huge population centers. So it's a good spot, especially in the early days of the space age when you're blowing up a lot of rockets because you don't really know what you're doing yet, to go out and test out a bunch of that kind of stuff. And then it evolved, obviously, into being a huge center of the space industry. Strategically, from the Starship perspective, they're pretty limited from what they can do in Boca Chica. So if you...
And this is the Texas launch site,
the Texas launch site. If you look at the map, right, and there's only really two lanes that they could fly. You think launching out of Texas, flying east over the Gulf, you can either miss Cuba to the north or miss Cuba to the south. Those are your two options, basically, so that you don't fly over heavily populated areas. So we always knew that going in, that this launch site was going to be fairly limited in terms of what's called a launch azimuth. Which direction can you launch from? Florida is much wider. Cape Canaveral can fly everything up the eastern seaboard, like the way to the ISS. And then recently, SpaceX has returned the polar corridor to Florida, meaning they fly south, kind of skirt the coast of Florida, past Miami, eventually take a little bit of a turn, and you can get yourself to polar orbit. So you've got a huge range of azimuth opportunities from Florida that you don't have from Texas. Boca Chica over in Texas, they were only able to launch 5 times a year to start, and now they've upped that to 25 times a year, and they'll certainly go higher than that. Getting a spot where they can fly so many times is really important, especially for a vehicle like Starship that not only needs a launch, but then it needs to continually launch fuel up to refuel depots in orbit to then get refueled and fly elsewhere in the solar system. They have built an architecture that needs them to fly tens, hundreds of times a month. Like, you know, long term, they're talking thousands of times a year. To do anything interesting on their roadmap requires way more flights than most vehicles. And so they need something like Florida that's able to handle that kind of cadence.
What goes into making that decision? You mentioned that Florida is a great place, especially in the early days of rocketry and space exploration, because things were blowing up. There weren't a lot of people around here. But it has since increased in population density, and selfishly, I have moved closer to these launch pads. So what goes into making sure that it's safe? Because SpaceX, the Starship, tends to explode, right?
I think up till now, everyone's kind of assumed that the Texas launch site for Starship was kind of going to be the messy test site where they're trying something out for the first time, new vehicle versions. It's a good spot to experiment when you don't have the gravity that it is to launch out of Cape Canaveral or Kennedy Space Center. Those are really critically important sites for the nation. They're some of the most strategically important positions on the continent, really, right? Like there are huge infrastructure elements that we depend on to get access to not only the ISS, but into orbit for military satellites or just civil satellites for weather forecasting. So they're very important. So we kind of assumed it's going to be a little bit more buttoned up that gets out to Florida, and the system will be a little bit more mature before it gets there. when you're there, there's a lot of different aspects of safety, which is something that has been talked about a lot. The keep out zone concept, when you fuel a vehicle, you have to clear out a certain radius in case something does blow up. And that radius is dictated by how big the vehicle is, what kind of propellant it uses. And this impacts other people, right? So if NASA's doing something with the Space Launch System at Complex 39, you're probably not going to be able to work over the neighboring Complex 39A, where SpaceX would be flying Falcon 9s or something like that. You might have to clear out parts of your pad or parts of your infrastructure on the Cape because someone else next door is doing something with a lot of propellant. Now, what gets interesting is Starship is a vehicle based on methane and oxygen rather than kerosene and oxygen. And we don't really have a lot of good data yet on that much liquid methane and liquid oxygen exploding. And so the Space Force has chosen a very conservative explosivity index to start with. And so they say, let's assume that it is equivalent to the same mass of TNT exploding, which turns out to be about 10 times the size that it actually is when a methane vehicle explodes. So what that means right now is you have to clear out a huge amount of land when Starship does an activity or Nuke Len does an activity, even Terran 1 back in the day when that was flying, they had to clear out a larger area for that small, I mean, I think you touched it.
I did. Yeah, that was my fault.
So that little vehicle that you put your hands on, they had to clear out more space for that than they did for the Falcon Heavy launch that happened. Now, there's a lot of testing going on and the data will get better. But right now, that's going to be a huge impact for Starship that is now going to land right at Space Launch Complex 37, which is pretty central to a lot of the interesting stuff on Cape Canaveral. When they do operations, a huge amount of people are going to have their workday disrupted. Anytime that they put fuel in the vehicle right now.
You're listening to Are We There Yet here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Anthony Colangelo. He's the host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff. We're talking about SpaceX's plans to launch a Starship from Florida's Space Coast. Anthony, you bring up an interesting point because I was going to ask you about how other things that were happening around the Cape would slow down Starship from launching, but it seems like Starship could have more of an impact on its neighbors, right? What goes into consideration with that when granting them the approval to launch in Florida?
This is the environmental approval. So this was, you know, making sure that the plans they had for the site are environmentally appropriate, that there's no significant impact. Now, I think that's a little different here than it was when they were going through this process in Texas, which was a launch site that hadn't existed yet. Kennedy Space Center, Cape Canaveral, they've existed for tens of years. And we've seen the kind of nice environmental effects of that, right? Like, how many times have you crossed paths with the gator when you're heading out to a launch out there? It's
quite a bit, yeah.
A very cool wildlife area, right? Yeah. But that said, they're installing their hardware basically at a site that already existed and hosted a very large launch vehicle. This was the Delta IV Heavy Pad. Up until SpaceX started flying their vehicles, was the largest launch vehicle operating in the world. So this site was built for these large boosters. It already hosted one. So to say, you know, there's no significant environmental impact, it doesn't mean, you know, comparing to nothing. It means comparing to another enormous launch vehicle that was there before. What it does on the level of like impacts to day-to-day work, that's going to be something that people always watch because we want to make sure everybody is productive in using national assets like Cape Canaveral. But that said, I mean, we tend to bias towards the people doing things. And so if SpaceX is more active than the others, they're going to have more impacts than the others. And the others are going to complain, certainly, that we're getting impacted by Starship.
I did not realize it was the Delta IV heavy launch pad, which ironically always started with an explosion, right? When they would burn off that hydrogen.
Very fiery.
So what happens next? I mean, is work underway for this launch pad?
Yeah, if you drive around Cape Canaveral right now, you'll see a lot of the sections of the tower already assembled. If you know where to look when you're on like the KSC bus tour, you'll probably catch sight of some of the hardware. Of course, a couple years ago, they had built the tower at launch pad 39A. Which they use for Falcon Heavy and Falcon 9. So they assemble those somewhere else, the actual sections of the tower, and then they'll bring them out to stack them up. Before they get to that, at this point, most of that old launch pad has been demolished. SpaceX is going to start building out the actual ground level infrastructure that they need. So the base of the launch pad and every system that's down there, they'll start putting in their water tanks that they need for sound suppression, the fuel tanks that they need to be able to support such an enormous vehicle like this. And it looks like based on the documentation filed, they'll be able to support about 2.5 fillings of the vehicle with the amount of storage that they're putting on each pad, which is more than they're able to do in Texas. And really, the way that you'll see that come to pass is if they go to fuel the vehicle and then they have a scrub and they have to detank the vehicle, they don't have to refill their tanks before they try again. There's a little bit of reserve there. So it should allow them to be smoother through operations. So all those systems are going to go in and then they'll probably start stacking the tower in a couple of months. And they say they're going to target like a year to readiness. That seems overly aggressive. I wouldn't be shocked if that was 18 months or something like that. This will be the third and fourth pad that they've built in this design. One out in Texas, one up in 39A. And then these two are the next versions. So every time they do it, they get a little bit better. But a lot of the metal for the tower and the chopstick catch arms is already there waiting to get put up at these two pads.
So they're still going to use the 39A pad as well as this one. So they'll have multiple pads.
Every pad. If you let them use your pad, they'll probably use your pad too. There can never be enough pads for Starship.
Yeah, and that brings me to my next question, Anthony, is you mentioned this at the start of our conversation. In order for Starship to be used for Artemis and the moon landing, there needs to be a lot of launches. They need to do orbital fueling to refuel these. Walk us through briefly what that plan is and where SpaceX stands now, because it's kind of under the microscope when it comes to getting Starship developed for use for Artemis.
I kept thinking about it in that way of like, how many launches are they going to need to fill up the thing that they launch? So they'll launch the lander for Artemis and then they'll launch a bunch of things to fill it up, right? They were going to fill a depot that then fills the lander. And then somebody was talking to me and was like, stop thinking about it like that. Just think about the fact that they will just always keep a fuel depot filled up with propellant. So in the way that Falcon 9 is just always launching Starlinks, Starship is just going to always be launching propellant and keep that thing totally topped up. You won't even be able to trace how many launches did it take to launch the Artemis lander, because it's like, I don't know, I went to the gas station, picked up some gas, and then I went out to the moon. It's probably going to bias more in that direction, that they will just continually launch Starships to make sure that their propellant depot stays full. And then once the lander's ready, launch the lander, fill it up, fly it to the moon.
Do those launches have to be exclusively fuel, or can they put other things on it? Is that where your head is going?
That is where my head is going. We don't know officially yet, but I would surmise that there's enough to be able to launch some Starlinks and then take whatever leftover propellant to fill the depot and then head on home and just integrate it fully across. Now, none of that is true or proven or whatever, but I don't even know, maybe SpaceX doesn't even know the final answers to some of these things, but just the concept of like the way it's been talked about always with Artemis is, how many launches does it take to fill up that lander? And I've been convinced recently to stop thinking about it like that and just think about Starship's going to be launching all the time, always filling a propellant depot. And what can you do with that when that is true?
Refilling launches aside, there are still issues with Starship, right? Where are we now? There was a recent explosion of a new version while it was tanking for a test. What do we know about that? And does this delay that actual Artemis lander from getting in orbit?
We know some things. I know some things. I know that it was a COPV that did explode, and I don't know exactly what happened to it yet. They're still trying to figure out the root cause of it.
That's the pressure vessel of the vehicle, which holds the fuel.
Yep. There's like a little, compressed bottle of, gas and whatever else you need on board, commodities-wise, that's inside the tank. That exploded and ripped open its tank on this test start, or the next booster that they were actually building. It doesn't seem like that's going to delay them all too much, to be honest. That was booster 18. Booster 19 is the one that they shift focus to now. I don't think that's going to set them back too many weeks, to be honest, before they get ready for this next test flight of Starship, which is the V3 vehicle. Not a good start. We were all hoping the teething issues. I feel like I came on this show a bunch of times after every explosion in the last year. I keep coming on to talk about Starship because it keeps having these incidents. Thought they had gotten through that after a couple of good test flights with V2 there, and they're moving on to this V3 vehicle. That is the one that's supposed to be able to test orbital refilling and a lot of these new advanced things they need to do. Hopefully they still are able to fly early in 2026 and get that first launch underway. Eventually, once they verify that all the hardware looks good, they'll go to actual orbit. They haven't officially been into orbit yet with Starship. They've been just suborbital to come around and land on the other side of Earth. Hopefully this gets them over that jump and they go complete a full orbit, do some refilling tests. All of those are the kind of, think about this like the Gemini program of Starship. Like, we have a whole bunch of different operations and technology we need to prove out so that we can go do the moon landing. That's what Gemini was in terms of Apollo. This upcoming phase of Starship is test out docking and refilling and reuse of the ship, catch of the ship, all these different technological elements that they need for their full infrastructure really come into play.
Anthony Colangelo is the host of the podcast Main Engine Cutoff, co-host of the Off Nominal podcast.
All good Starship vibes from here.
Still to come, a shocking discovery on Mars.
Oh my gosh, we're getting like static electricity as these dust devils move over the rover.
How scientists found lightning on the red planet. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
So Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the UCF College of Business, offering the new online space MBA, designed for professionals in innovative and high-growth industries. Beginning spring 2026, students gain advanced business skills through the lens of the space economy. Learn more at business.ucf.edu/space MBA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. The holidays are just around the corner. Many of us have our own holiday traditions. Well, the same goes for astronauts living and working in orbit on the International Space Station. Later this month, we'll hear from one of those astronauts and find out how they celebrate holidays from orbit. That's later this month on Are We There Yet? But for now, we turn to Mars, where NASA's Perseverance rover discovered a shocking revelation. Lightning. The Perseverance rover accidentally picked up the unique sounds of lightning with a microphone on its SuperCam instrument. In the swirling mayhem of a dust devil storm, researchers can hear bits of static and electricity that confirm that mini lightning bolts can happen on Mars. Here to talk more about the electric news on Mars and what's ahead for NASA's rovers this holiday season is Amy Williams. She's an astrobiologist at the University of Florida and a scientist on the Perseverance and Curiosity missions. Amy, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Thanks so much for having me back.
So a really interesting finding from our friend Perseverance. Lightning? What did you find?
Yeah, it's so hard because lightning is so exciting. And then when you actually like think about what this is more like, do you remember that Family Guy episode when Peter has like the footy pajamas on and he's like skittering across the carpet to build up a charge so he can zap someone? It's a little more like this than proper lightning.
I love how we're able to use a Family Guy reference in here to explain something scientific.
You know, I think there's a lot of relevance in this particular example. And, you know, if you got zapped by one of these little electric charges, it'd feel more like that than being struck by lightning. So perhaps for a safety component, maybe that's a good thing to know about Mars.
Certainly. How did scientists come about discovering this?
So, and this is actually a really cool opportunity that we were able to leverage with Perseverance and with the SuperCam instrument, which has a microphone on board. So this is the way, for example, that we have our first, you know, sounds of Mars, what it's like to hear the wind blowing across the plains. And one of the cool things that it can do is, you know, be turned on and operational and listening when we get hit by dust devils. Dust devils are pretty common on Mars. And we've been hit by like 15 or 16, I think, at this point. And so, you know, it's not Matt Damon scale blowing anyone over kind of thing, but they are little tiny dust devils that buzz over the rover. And the cool thing that the microphone can do is actually pick up on these little like snaps and pop sounds. And we were able to kind of correlate this with like electrostatic discharge, like these measurements that told us, oh my gosh, we're getting like static electricity as these dust devils move over the rover.
I want to take a quick step back because the SuperCam has a microphone on it. You know, I'm going to be fascinated by microphones because of my job. It wasn't put on Perseverance to listen for lightning strikes, right? It serves a purpose. What does SuperCam's microphone do?
I got to step back even further and say SuperCam is like four or five instruments in one, right? It can do VIS-IR, LIBS, which is laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy. It can take pictures with this remote micro imager. It can do Raman, and it can listen. It wasn't put on board in order for us to listen for Mars micro lightning, but it is set up for us to listen to the wind to be able to kind of get a sense for what the surface of the planet is like. And it might also be helpful if, for example, we had some kind of issue where we, you know, hear some kind of squeaky sound from the rover, then, you know, that might help us to diagnose something. But it certainly has a major like discovery component to it. And it's really exciting because you can put something like this on a rover and have, I was going to say a surprise discovery, but I think that is probably one in the same where, you know, we had no idea we would be able to hear static electricity on Mars, but we absolutely can.
Going back to that finding, as you mentioned, you want to find out what it's like on the surface of Mars, but knowing that there are these kind of micro lightning strikes within these dust devils has got to paint an even more vivid picture of what is happening on the surface, right?
It gives us an opportunity to kind of think about these, you know, what you might think of as a micro scale process occurring on Mars. But if you have, this is called the triboelectric effect. And so this is a way for us to maybe understand how there are these micro reactions occurring on the surface of Mars that maybe we hadn't had confirmed yet without confirming this type of electricity. And when you have these sand grains kind of spinning together, this is how you are developing this charged environment. It's a known thing that happens with sandstorms and even with the snowstorms on Earth. Because Mars's atmosphere is thinner than Earth's, this is actually more likely to occur on Mars, because the amount of charge that's required to make these kinds of like sparks is lower than what would be required on Earth. It's just like an atmospheric density property. It gives us a sense for like, is this a way to sort of be driving forward some chemical reactions that we really hadn't thought about necessarily occurring due to static electricity on the surface of Mars.
Thinking back to our analogy of Peter Griffin rubbing his feet and zapping people, you know, anybody who's gotten a static shock knows it's a bit jolting. But for sensitive electronics, that can be bad, right? You know, you wear an anti-static band when you're working on your computer to prevent that stuff. What are there any concerns that the static electricity or these micro lightning strikes pose to Perseverance? I'm kind of worried for it.
Oh, I don't think that there's any concern. You know, we haven't had issues for probably decades now with something along those lines messing with one of the rovers or landers or any of the electronics on board. We have also like continued to improve upon sort of the grounding practices that we have with the vehicles. So if there was something, there was a potential issue, then it would be able to be mitigated. So, I mean, it's a confirmation of sort of something we weren't sure might be a problem for a rover or a lander, but it sounds like we already, you know, kind of engineered our way out of it for the most part. So other than getting to listen to these little like snap crackle pops, it seems like Perseverance just gets to be the lucky vehicle that gets to be run over by dust devils on a routine basis on Mars.
Well, is there any concern for that? I mean, you mentioned this wasn't kind of the Martian kind of event that would knock Perseverance over. But are there any implications from these dust devils passing over, Percy?
Actually, the dust devils might be kind of useful. They were actually the saving grace for the Mars exploration rover Spirit and Opportunity, because they were solar powered. And so it actually is sort of a cleaning service to remove dust from the solar panels on those vehicles when they were operational. On Perseverance and Curiosity now, of course, we have a radionuclei power source, and so we don't need the solar panels, but you do accumulate a lot of dust on the rover deck. So it's more of a cleaning service than anything for the most part. We kind of monitor dust accumulation on the rover deck, gives us a little bit of an idea of like how rapidly that material might accumulate on a surface. But yeah, it's more just this awesome curiosity to watch these things kind of roll over. And it's fun because we also do take pictures when we're monitoring the dust devils. And so you take a couple of pictures in a quick succession, you can get a GIF from that. And we've actually documented watching other dust devils ahead of us, and then you just see like us sort of get obscured by a dust devil actually running over the rover.
Oh, wow. Kind of like that scene from Twister, right?
Yes, I know. And it's so hard for me to not relate this to thinking about Twister, but it's all going to have to be like micro twisters and micro lightning. Yeah, for Mars.
Okay, well, it gives it a nice bath, much like how I use a Florida rainstorm to consider that a car wash, right?
It's such a shame, but it's true.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Amy Williams. She is a professor of astrobiology at the University of Florida, also a scientist on NASA's Perseverance and Curiosity rovers. Amy, let's talk a bit about something that happens every 2 years. It is conjunction. What does that mean?
So we are coming up on the time of year when Mars is on the other side of the sun from Earth. And although we have accomplished an incredible amount of technological advancement in communicating with vehicles all across the solar system, we cannot, in fact, talk through the sun yet or ever.
Oh, come on.
I know. There are limitations to physics. When Mars is behind the sun relative to Earth, we go into what's called conjunction, when we don't communicate with the vehicles. So we are getting ready to do that. And we're actually taking a longer break than usual because conjunction happens to kind of start right when most folks are coming back from sort of end of year holidays. And so we've been planning these multi-sol plans that kind of feed forward into conjunction so that you have the ability to perform very low energy observation. So you can't move the mast. You can't really do a whole heck of a lot, but we are able to use this opportunity as sort of an environmental monitoring time. If you can set the cameras in such a way that you can take an image of the same spot, you can perform change detection observations. And the cool thing about this particular holiday plus conjunction timeframe is that it's going to be about a month. And so that's actually a pretty decent amount of time on Mars to be able to look at any potential change detection. And we're thinking about like sand grains moving along, right? Watching for dust devils, stuff like that. So no one's going to get buried by a sand dune, but it is a cool opportunity to be able to do some stuff when you're just sitting still, because we literally cannot communicate with the vehicles and have them do anything else. But we're working up to that now. And so pretty soon we have to get to the point where we're parked in a safe location. Number one, a dune can't migrate over you, but also pointed in such a way so that we could communicate with the rover via the high gain antenna if we needed to. So it's this whole like ballet of getting like just in the right spot. And then we're going to sit there for a month. And hopefully I'll take a minute to first enjoy the holidays, but then also, you know, work on papers, work on our science. We get a little staycation from the rovers and they get a vacation from us.
Do you tell the rover that you're coming back? I feel bad for it.
I don't know that it gets concerned. I don't think it has separation anxiety. We've given it the plans, so it kind of knows what it's doing every day. So, you know, although I have a probably unhealthy emotional attachment to the rovers, they seem to get along just fine without us for a month while we tell them what to do and they carry on with their rover lives.
That's kind of nice. It is a forced kind of long-term observation, right? You really wouldn't take a month to stare at sand grains.
Correct. Correct.
On a normal, right.
With a rover. Yeah. And, you know, that's one of the cool things with the lander is that you do sometimes have these like sort of like semi-permanent monitoring stations. But with a rover, man, you don't want to waste the opportunity to rove somewhere. So this is a good opportunity to get these kinds of observations when we normally wouldn't.
And finally, Amy, when you come back and you're able to communicate with Perseverance and Curiosity, what's on the docket for them in the new year?
So Curiosity is still working in what we've called the boxwork area. So that place that's sort of a mix of these ridges and hollow areas. We are just completing sort of one coupled observation of a ridge and a hollow and trying to understand why are they different? Why do they look different? Are they chemically different? So we're going to be working on processing those data over the holiday. And depending on what we get out of that, you know, we might have other ridge hollow couples that we want to explore to understand how did this form? And is it this evidence for this ancient habitable environment in the subsurface that's now been eroded down and exposed today? And then with Perseverance, we are roving to the west toward this place called Lac de Charme, which should have all of these ancient Nowakian terrains. So yeah, so we are exploring ancient terrains, ancient subsurface environments, and possibly ancient habitable environments in the new year.
Amy Williams is an astrobiologist with the University of Florida, also a scientist on the Perseverance and Curiosity missions. Amy, always a pleasure and happy new year.
Thank you so much. Happy new year.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. If you have an idea for a future episode of this show, or you'd like to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.